The first day of March, and Spectrum West is on the air. It's our third month, of course. It honors Mars, the Roman god of war. You may not have known that. It's the month in which spring starts. We wouldn't miss that for the world. First day of March is often stormy. The last day is usually mild and warm. Thus the adage, March comes in like a lion and goes out like a lamb. Have you heard the other saying? April borrowed from March 3 days, and they were ill. This refers to the first 3 days of April, which are generally rough and blustery, like a lot of March. A third saying calls the first 3 days of March blind days because they are unlucky. Well, I hope not. If rain falls on these days, farmers supposedly will have poor harvests. Ides of March, 15th. Then everyone is Irish on the 17th with the celebration of St. Patrick's Day. Birthdays include Alexander Graham Bell on the 3rd, Michelangelo and Elizabeth Barrett Browning, Ring Lardner on the 6th. The first transatlantic radio broadcast was on the 12th of March in 1925. Johann Strauss, born on the 14th, Johann Sebastian Bach on the 21st, Robert Frost and Tennessee Williams on the 26th, Joseph Haydn on the 31st. Today on Spectrum West, we're going to introduce you to Noah Hain. He's performing tonight at the Heide Center in Chippewa Falls. He's a bright guy, very ambidextrous, and a good musician who uses technology to accompany and build songs around himself. We welcome Roger Reynolds, who has creative ways to garden that can bring yours to life and do so without the aggravation of constant weeding. Jim Oliver talks with Kathy Welch of the Old Gem Theater about a touching production called I Never Saw Another Butterfly that opens tonight. And you know what? I'll bet you may not have thought you'd ever hear about the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service on a program like Spectrum West. Well, we take our first name, Spectrum, very seriously. And when that Fish and Wildlife Service sponsors an art contest for young people, well, heck yes, it gives us the chance to make a new acquaintance. In this case, it's Georgia Parham, who works at the Midwest region in Bloomington, Indiana. The contest is all about endangered species. First, a bit about the Fish and Wildlife Service, if you would, please. We've heard of it. What kind of services does the Fish and Wildlife Service do for us?
We are the federal agency under the Department of the Interior that, on a national basis, works to conserve and protect fish and wildlife, plants, and their habitats. And we do that through our trust resources, which would include endangered species, federally endangered species. It would include some nationally significant fish populations. It would include national wildlife refuges. And then resources like migratory birds that kind of share the continent. So we are basically the federal entity that oversees that part of conservation for the United States.
Hmm. How do you work with state departments of natural resources? Do you have superiority over them, or do you just work with them, or what goes on there?
We are very close partners with the states, and we don't have superiority over them. States carry out state management of fish and wildlife. On a state level, we fund a lot of their programs through grants. We work together closely on issues that impact both of our agencies. Endangered species is one of them. Working together, that's a pretty strong partnership, and as well as migratory birds, habitat enhancements, that kind of thing. We work very closely with the state.
Uh-huh. Fish, obviously, is a self-explanatory term, but what is entailed in wildlife?
It's animals and plants, actually. We do recognized endangered plant species, and, of course, plants are a huge component of any habitat system. So plants are a very important part of what the Fish and Wildlife Service does.
Where would the regular person see the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in action?
Well, if you have a national wildlife refuge nearby, that's probably the most common place to see the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. We also run national fish hatcheries in some parts of the country, including the Midwest. We also have a law enforcement component. They also work closely with our state partners, and they help enforce federal wildlife regulations such as the Endangered Species Act, the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, and other regulations that would cover interstate transport of animals and that kind of thing. So we do have a presence. We're not as numerous as some of our state counterparts, but we are present in every state in the country.
Uh-huh. And how long has the FWS been around?
Well, we started out in the early part of the century, in fact, probably before that, under a different name. And we've kind of evolved into the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. In fact, our refuge system, the National Wildlife Refuge System, celebrated its 100th anniversary in 2003. Mm-hmm. So we've been around quite a long time.
A bit of history about the Endangered Species Act. How long has that been around?
The act as we know it today was signed into law by President Nixon in December of 1973. So this is actually the 40th anniversary of the Endangered Species Act. And, mm-hmm. and you'll see our agency kind of highlighting endangered species work throughout the year this year because of the 40th anniversary.
Every once in a while, we see headlines that depict what you do and how you do it as somewhat of a political football. Has it been that way over the years?
Well, we're a science-based agency, and yeah. so what we do is based on the best science we have available to us. So I'm sure that in some cases the issues we deal with are viewed as political. Our bottom line is we have trust resources that we are obligated to conserve and protect, and we use the best science we know to do that.
You mentioned in a sentence a while back the word treaty. I'm curious how well we do working with others. I know, obviously, our closest neighbor is Canada, but of course, you know, what you're doing and what you're trying to accomplish is a global effort. How is the global effort going? Is everyone buying into the fact that there are some things that need preserving?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I think I mentioned the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, and that's a treaty that we have with Canada and Mexico because our waterfowl and migratory birds, you know, traverse the continent, basically. But we also have an international component that is very active. We are a member of the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, and there are at least 100 other nations that are party to that conference or a convention. We meet regularly. In fact, this is a year that the nations are coming together to meet to talk about, in this case, endangered species and those that are threatened by illegal trade. So we're a very active part of that effort, and we have many, many international partners, too.
Okay. Well, my apologies to Mexico for not considering them a close neighbor. I actually live in the north, so seemed as if Canada was our only closest neighbor. We're talking with Georgia Parham. She is in external affairs in the Midwest region of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. She is stationed in Bloomington, Indiana. We're going to get momentarily to a topic that deals with things we talk about on Spectrum West, which is the arts and culture and humanities. That is the 8th annual Endangered Species Day Youth Art Contest. First, Georgia, talk about what the Fish and Wildlife Service does by way of educating young people. You probably have a lot of programs.
We do. We reach out to young people through many of our programs, whether it's fisheries, our refuge system, our endangered species, our contaminants biologists, migratory birds. We have a lot of avenues to reach young people, and it's been a very high priority for our agency because we see youth as kind of the future of the conservation effort. So it's very important to our agency to reach out to kids, and the Endangered Species Art Contest is just one of the ways that we do that.
Definitely the future of what you're trying to accomplish.
Exactly, yes.
8th Annual Endangered Species Day Youth Art Contest. Endangered Species Day, was it formulated for that purpose, to involve young people?
Endangered Species Day was started in 2006 by the Congress, and it was basically to recognize and celebrate our nation's rarest plants and animals. The Youth Art Contest became a part of that and has become a very important and popular part of celebrating Endangered Species Day.
Moms and dads and grandparents and even young kids are listening now. What kinds of pieces of art can they submit? What do you encourage them to do? Does it have to have something to do with fish and wildlife?
Well, what we're encouraging kids to do is to learn about endangered and threatened species around them. They can submit entries for any listed species, an endangered species, and it could be a mammal, a bird, a reptile, a plant, an insect that's found in the United States and is listed as endangered. We encourage kids to depict species that are found in their area just because it's a great way to learn about the nature around them and how important that is. So that's what we encourage, but obviously any listed species as endangered would be eligible.
Do you work with schools on this project?
We let school art teachers know, scout groups, any kind of youth organization, homeschooled kids. Any child who is interested in art is encouraged to submit an entry, and we get really great entries.
Four categories, kindergarten through grade 2, grades 3 to 5, grades 6 to 8, and grades 9 to 12. Mm-hmm. The reason we're airing this today is that the deadline is coming up. It's March 15th. Tell us where people can, I know they can get an entry form at a website, and you'll give us that, but how do they submit their entries?
Well, the information on submitting an entry is included in the entry form, and there's an address and some information on how to send your artwork, how to sign it, how to protect it during shipping, and that kind of thing. That's all part of the instructions and entry form that are found on the website.
And the website is?
It would be endangeredspeciesday.org.
Well, Georgia Parham, thanks so much for all the information, and thanks for all you guys do in the important work you have every day. Keep in touch with us here at Spectrum West. We appreciate it.
Thanks very much.
Now, again, as a recap, the categories are kindergarten to second grade, grades 3 to 5, grades 6 to 8, and then 9 to 12. So you can encourage your kids to draw something, and even more importantly, help them understand what it is they're drawing and why that thing is important to all of us. There will be 40 semifinalists, and the grand prize winner gets a flight to Washington, D.C. with a guardian for a reception in May. Again, the deadline is March 15th, and all the info you need is at endangeredspeciesday.org. 18 minutes after 5, this is Spectrum West.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Ken Vance Volkswagen, featuring the new 2013 Volkswagen Jetta with the keyless push-button system, allowing drivers to start and unlock the Jetta without using keys. More at kenvance.com.
Support also comes from the Chippewa Valley Symphony. The Youthful Expressions Concert features the Chippewa Valley Youth Symphony and the Young Artist Winner, March 9th at the Eau Claire Regional Arts Center. Details are available at cvsymphony.org.
Here's a Spectrum memo. Author and storyteller Rob Reed will read from and sign copies of his new book, Silly Books to Read Aloud, tomorrow at the UW Eau Claire Bookstore from 10 a.m. to noon. Had him on to talk about it. A lot of fun. But you know, there are musicians and there are musicians. With some, it's enough to just hear them. For others, it's vital that you also watch them produce their music. One such musician is Noah Hain, and tonight, on the stage of the Heide Center in Chippewa Falls, he will produce his brand of music from several instruments and microphones all at once. You see, he's a one-man band in our electronic world of the 21st century. Before we get into what you do and how you do it, give me the story of how and when music took over.
Oh, man, that's a great question. I've always kind of played music and been interested. You know, my parents told me the stories of I would pull out the oatmeal cans and the pot and pans and bang on them. They kind of fostered, I guess, taking me to lessons at a young age before it was offered in schools. So drums was kind of how I started. And my mom said, hey, you have to learn to play piano first. So I started piano young and then drums soon after that, and developed a love of percussion kind of as I went along, timpani and mallet instruments, and everything that that symphonic percussion had to offer. I kind of got serious in my teens, you know, playing in rock bands and playing in concert band and doing jazz and, you know, just kind of learning as I went. And I kind of realized, like, this is really what I love to do. There's other subjects in school that I enjoy, but music is just kind of a deep love. How far can I take this? That was kind of my attitude, maybe 15, 16. I quit piano and focus solely on percussion, and I made the Minnesota All-State Band. All right, geez, I'm pretty good at this.
Yeah.
At that moment, I missed having something melodic in my arsenal when I quit piano, and that's when I started playing harmonica. I borrowed a guitar, and I bought a cheap little harmonica, and I said, I'm going to give this 2 weeks, and I'll pick one of these. I was terrible at guitar. I was pretty good at harmonica. I have kind of short fingers. So that stuck. And it was just kind of something fun. Was playing in church and playing in a few places, and there was a group of guys that had kind of this old-style rock and roll band, you know.
Sure.
I grew up in small-town Minnesota, and they said, hey, you want to play some rock and roll in some bars? I'm like, hey, why not? Let's do it. So that was kind of a baptism by fire kind of thing, you know. I was in college. I went to school for symphonic percussion. I'm classically trained, reading music, playing etudes, studying serious music, studying composition, music theory, counterpoint. And then at night, I'm moonlighting playing blues and rock mm-hmm. in bars. Mm-hmm. A few failed rock bands later and learning about the business and kind of trying to navigate making a living as a musician mm-hmm. after graduating from college. That's the genesis of the show that I'll be bringing to Chippewa Falls tonight. That is really the heart of it.
Oh, okay.
Two worlds colliding, like classical percussion and blues harmonica.
Well, you do a good job of whetting our appetite, I'll tell you that. You are described as a quote-unquote fierce performer and as having quote-unquote zen-like concentration. Those kinds of descriptions will raise our bar of expectation. For sure. Here's a good question. Is that you doing it to your music, or is your music doing it to you?
I would say it's me doing it to my music.
Okay.
Naturally, the music responds. The Zen-like concentration refers to the way that I perform my music, and that is with a foundation of technology. I use looping. So what I'm doing is recording myself live on stage.
Yep.
And building kind of layer by layer of instruments to create the songs. While I'm doing that, I'm arranging them live on stage while singing and soloing at the same time. So with all the different instruments that I play, I'm also kind of tap dancing on pedals on the floor to arrange the music as I go. And that's kind of where this dual brain zen-like concentration comes from.
That's the voice of Noah Hain. He is a musician, a one-man band, and a loopy kind of guy, appearing tonight at the Heide Center at 7:30. That's in Chippewa Falls. He has already described what looping is. I saw the word construction used, and that is kind of cool to describe what it is you do, because you literally build a song, don't you?
That is correct, yeah. And I'll explain it during the show.
Okay.
I'll play a song or two, and then I'll describe looping, describe a demonstration, and then also demonstrate exactly what I'm doing and how I'm doing it. There are other loop artists out there. It's becoming more and more popular. But I realize that as a harmonica player, I'm not able to sing and play my instrument at the same time like a guitarist would. So I needed to have more flexibility with the looping in order to accompany myself with the harmonica. That led down a long and winding road, the proverbial rabbit hole, to the point where I actually programmed my own looping system in order to have more flexibility. You know, you see some loop artists, they have, you know, maybe 5 or 6 buttons in front of them.
Yeah.
I have 87 buttons and faders that I use to pull this show off.
Wow.
I didn't stop, basically. I just kept adding and adding and changing and changing. And the point was to be able to have as much flexibility as I could with the arrangements of the songs, to really be able to do most of what a group of musicians could do and not be limited by mm-hmm. the looping.
It's kind of like musical juggling, isn't it, what you do?
Yes, that is a great way to put it.
And you depend on technology. I mean, I'll bet you pray the power doesn't go out.
Yeah, that's happened to me.
Oh, yeah, I bet. And when it does, therein comes the tap dancing.
Yeah.
And you know what? I can imagine you really sympathizing, or maybe the word should be empathizing, with those one-man bands of yesterday. I mean, your act takes coordination, but they were no slouches either.
No, yeah. Are you talking about the guys with the, they're walking around with...
Oh, sure. He had, like, cymbals on their knees, and they had sat there and played...
10 trumpets strapped to them that they'd play.
Yeah.
They'd have, like, a guitar and another one that would spin around from their back while carrying a bass drum, and
mm-hmm.
and they would dance and sing and play 10 things at the same time.
And they didn't have to plug anything in.
No. They had an advantage over me, really.
Question, is your music original, or will the audience recognize some stuff?
I like to do a good mix,
okay,
almost a 50-50 mix, and I'll feel the audience out a little bit. But generally, I like to do a bit of original material, explain what I'm doing with the looping and the technology, then do some songs that they may know, covers by U2, Coldplay, some old blues standards, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Something for them to grasp onto, and then also introduce the instruments that I have, because they might not be familiar with African udu and Peruvian cajon, and even marimba, perhaps.
Cool.
So I like to keep it as kind of a mix.
I've seen a lot of different eclectic kinds of acts and musical aggregations at the Heidi Center over the years, and I have to say that I think your show's going to fill that place nicely.
Okay, good.
I hope so. As the sound, I think, is going to be perfect. It's a wonderful, wonderful old auditorium. And I have to say, Noah Hain, that although it hasn't been done yet, which is what you brought up earlier, singing and playing the harmonica at the same time, if it's ever done, I think you're going to be the guy to do it.
Good. I hope to be. One of the things that I, as an artist, that's what drives me, is to create something new and
mm-hmm,
different,
mm-hmm,
to experiment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who hears marimba layered with harmonica and percussion? I mean, it hasn't been done. And looking at the background that I had that I described earlier, who's going to do it if not me, you know?
I appreciate your energy, and I think people are going to enjoy the show, so have fun tonight.
Great. Thank you very much.
There you go. Noah Hain, unique individual, and it'll be a unique show. It starts at 7:30 tonight at the Heidi Center for the Arts. That is in Chippewa Falls. Nothing going on. This could be one of those last-minute decisions that you will talk about for quite a while. Tickets available at the door. You know what? If you're not convinced, go to his website and watch him build these songs. It's pretty cool. NoahHain.com. It's N-O-A-H, of course, and then H-O-E-H-N. Hain. H-O-E-H-N.com. Spectrum West continues on the first day of March, 2013. I'm Al Ross. Thanks for being with us today. Volume 1 is hosting the work of illustrator Ned Gannon at their gallery within their headquarters and local store on Dewey Street in Eau Claire. There's an opening reception this evening, beginning at 6:30. The exhibit will be up through April 29th. At the Phipps Center in Hudson, the Lake Wobegon Brass Band performs tomorrow at 7 p.m. There are preschool art classes for students 2.5 to 4. The Phipps Dance Company has their 8th annual performances Friday and Saturday, March 15th and 16th. There's a St. Patrick's Day concert featuring Cool Ruah, an Irish trio on St. Paddy's Day, Sunday the 17th at 7 p.m. Ballroom dance parties, stand-up comedy class starting March 4th. The gallery's always busy, and there's a host of other stuff always going on in Hudson. Information at thephipps.org. The life and work of James Baucom, or Baucom, B-A-K-K-O-M, a Minneapolis artist and film production designer, is being presented within an exhibit in the Furlong Gallery, featuring production drawings, paintings, film, stills, and video, and that's up through March 29th. That's at UW Stout. The gallery is open daily from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Let's see, what else can I tell you here? Spectrum memo, got a couple sheets worth today. Taking time out from an active touring and studio schedule, saxophonist Adam Larson presents a guest recital Sunday at 2 p.m. Phillips Recital Hall of the Haas Fine Arts Center at UW Eau Claire. And I've got lots more Spectrum memoranda coming up for you during the program. You know, the very nice thing about this part of Wisconsin is the number of gems we'll find while looking for the arts. And then there are old gems. We have one in Jim Oliver, although he's not that old. And New Richmond has one as well. So here's one to talk about the other.
I never saw another butterfly. A story about the Holocaust that took place before and during World War II has opened for student audiences at the Old Gem Theater in New Richmond. Public performances are scheduled for this Saturday and Sunday. Joining us is Kathy Welch, Artistic Director at the Old Gem and Director of I Never Saw Another Butterfly. Thank you for coming back to talk to us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Well, in recent months, I have read a couple of books, fiction and nonfiction, both about the history of the Nazis and the years leading up to World War II and during the war. They also touch on the situation of the Soviet Union as well. It's just that the Soviets didn't keep as good a record as the Nazis, so we don't dwell so much on the horrors that happened there. But I'm also old enough to remember newsreel footage of the liberation of concentration camps in Germany that would play just before the latest Gene Autry feature film in my hometown theater. And I'm still horrified by what I read recently, just as I was to see those newsreel pictures of more than 60 years ago. So with that horrible opening, tell us about I Never Saw Another Butterfly.
Well, I Never Saw Another Butterfly is originally a book that was put together. Terezin, which was a Jewish ghetto in the Czech Republic, housed a lot of children. Over 15,000 children went through the gates of Terezin during the course of the Holocaust. And several of the women there decided to try and keep the kids' spirits up and keep the spirit of learning and the love of the arts alive by conducting classes. And they would have the children write poems and do paintings and things like that. And I Never Saw Another Butterfly is a collection of some of the paintings and poems that were written by the children that had survived, were hidden from the Nazis and survived. And then the play, I Never Saw Another Butterfly, is inspired by those paintings and the poetry from that book.
Now, who wrote the play?
The play is by Celeste Risponti, and she had done a lot of research talking to a few of the survivors from Terezin in putting together the play.
Now, it's a one-act play, is that right?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Yeah. So why did you select it for this time of the year?
We have found that there's a number of teachers that study World War II and the Holocaust at this time of year, and a lot of the shows that we do here at the Old Gem Theater are specifically for schools that come to the theater for their field trips, and we like to align our shows with the curriculum of the schools. And so it's nice to do something that fits the World War II theme or else having to do with the Holocaust, because the kids are studying it, and then they get to see something on stage that reflects what they're learning in the classroom.
Now, this is based on the book. So how is the play staged with just a collection of, based on a collection of writings and paintings? How does the play stage?
Yeah, sure. There's a main character, Raja Inglandarova, who was an actual survivor from Terezin, and it's sort of a memory play through her eyes. So we see her as a woman who has maybe 10 years or so after the incident, after the war, remembering both her family life before the war and then what happened to her when she went, what was in Terezin. And the focus is on the classroom and the learning that the children went through.
Now, this the cast includes members of your youth ensemble as well as your adult company.
Mm-hmm.
So how many people in the cast?
I'm going to have to think. Let's see, we've got 6 young actors and 2 adult actors, so 8 total.
Okay. How long does the show run?
We're offering it to schools through March 22nd.
How long is the performance?
Oh, it's about an hour long, and then during the public performances we take an intermission. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, talk a little bit about the school groups that attend, and do you do anything in anything special in addition to just doing the play?
We offer Q&A sessions with the cast, especially when we do these serious, more hard-hitting plays. Sometimes it really helps both the students and the young actors as well to have time to kind of digest the play. So after they see it, oftentimes we'll have the cast come out and talk to the students, answer any questions they have, talk about the process that they've gone through in creating the characters and getting the play up on stage.
She is Kathy Welch, who is Artistic Director of the Old Gem Theater in New Richmond and Director of I Never Saw Another Butterfly. Getting to the general topic of the Old Gem Theater, do you write some of the material that's presented there?
I, I do. Not this one, obviously, but oftentimes we do shows. In fact, we just closed Stone Soup, which was our January show geared for the younger set of elementary school, preschool students. Every year we take some sort of famous fairy tale, folk tale type story, and I usually do the adaptations for those, turn them into an audience participation play for the younger kids.
Now, the Old Gem reputation is pretty much as a children's theater. Do you do shows for older folk as well?
We do. We mix it up. We do comedy nights. We have a lot of guest artists come through to do comedy nights or sometimes music nights. We've got a rock and roll review coming up later in March that the White Sidewalls are going to be bringing to us to show for the adult audiences here at the Old Gem.
Well, let's talk about you a little bit. You earned your PhD in theater from the University of Hawaii. That sounds like a terrible place to go to school.
I did. It was awful.
But anyway, what brought you to New Richmond?
Both my husband and I are originally from the Twin Cities area. We grew up and went to the University of Minnesota. And so this is home. This is where our family is. And so when we finished up all that graduate school, looking at the country, deciding where we wanted to live, we wanted to come home, both for the family and the quality of life, as well as the amount of culture and theater and arts that are available in this area, in the Twin Cities area. And we had moved back and started doing a little bit of theater in the Twin Cities and got word that there was this really nice little theater in New Richmond, Wisconsin that was for sale. So we took a trip on out and took a look at it and fell in love and have been here 11 years now.
Wow, so I guess you found a home.
Huh? Yeah.
Did you, when you were going to school in theater, were you intending to be the owner of a theater someday, or did you want to act or direct professionally, or how did that go?
I got into theater initially because I was attracted to the backstage things. I really loved stage management and scene design and all that sort of thing, and the more I studied, I started directing and kind of found my home in the world of directing. So I went through and got my PhD with an eye towards maybe teaching, maybe at the university, but in a situation where I could direct as well. Because that was really my favorite thing to do. And then when this opportunity presented itself, like, hey, I could direct all the time. I don't have to do that teaching stuff, which is ironic because I teach all the time. We have all these classes at the theater, so.
Yeah, I noticed that you are listed as one of the actors in the adult ensemble. You do some acting, do you?
I do. I generally steer away from that when I'm directing a show. It's really difficult to direct and act. I find it difficult to do both. But there's been a couple of situations this year where just the casting has worked out that it was better for me to take a role. And actually, in Stone Soup, I ended up taking one because one of our actors had to drop out family reasons at the last minute. And so I, by default, became an actor in that show.
Mm-hmm. What comes next after I Never Saw Another Butterfly?
The next show we will start rehearsals for at the end of March is our big spring show that we do for a lot of schools come during the springtime for their spring field trip. And we are going to be doing Honk this year, which is a musical version from Broadway of the Hans Christian Andersen story, The Ugly Duckling. So a musical version of The Ugly Duckling.
Mm-hmm. And then you have summer classes, I take it?
We do. Each year in July, we have sort of an intensive theater program for kids. They come to the theater for 3 hours a day, 4 days a week. And then at the end of the session, we put on a show.
How broad an area do you attract students?
It's pretty broad. We get kids from Hudson and Stillwater, and up north they'll come from Amory. So, you know, especially during the summer when folks have a little bit more time to make the trip to the Old Gem, we'll get people from River Falls even.
Well, we've been visiting with Kathy Welch, Artistic Director of the Old Gem Theater in New Richmond and Director of I Never Saw Another Butterfly, a one-act play about the Holocaust. Currently playing for school groups during March, and in addition to performances for the schools, there are performances for the public at 7 p.m. Saturday and 2 p.m. on Sunday. For ticket information, you can go to the theater's website at oldgemtheater.com. Kathy Welch, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. We appreciate it.
And there you have it, ladies and gentlemen, another stellar Jim Oliver report. It's 5:41. 19 minutes before 6. And this is Spectrum West. Thanks so much for being with us today on the 1st of March. Support for Spectrum West and WPR comes from Festival Foods, dedicated to making every business decision based on the premise of bringing customers back. More about Festival Foods' boomerang theory at festivalfoods.com.
Support also comes from Wisconsin Credit Union, offering checking accounts that include a debit card, online banking and bill payment, call 24 phone access, automatic payments, direct deposit, and more. WisconsinCU.org.
Feed My People Food Bank holds its 13th annual Empty Bowls Benefit, 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. next Thursday the 7th at Florian Gardens in Eau Claire. Locally made soup, specialty breads, and desserts will be served, and you can take home an empty bowl donated by local students, community members, and artisans. There will also be silent auctions and more. Along those same lines, in the River Falls area, UW River Falls will host the 4th annual Bowls for Hope event. That is Tuesday the 12th in the Riverview Ballroom of the University Center. You can select and keep a bowl created by UWRF students or at River Falls High School, Meyer Middle School, the Renaissance Academy, and by area artists. You can sample soups donated and served by area restaurants. It happens from 5 to 7 p.m., and that's on March 12th. Sunday from 10 a.m. to 4:30 p.m., it's an art journaling workshop at the Stillwater, Minnesota studio of artist and writer Jane Grant Abban. Details at Abban, A-B-B-A-N, art.com. The Prairie Enthusiasts and the Eau Claire Master Gardeners are sponsoring a free public education event on creating prairie gardens and meadows and preserving our local native prairies. That's tomorrow at the L.A. Phillips Memorial Public Library in Eau Claire. It all begins at 10:30 a.m. Again, that's tomorrow, and it's in the Eau Claire Room. Tuesday Night Blues happens on the second Tuesday of each month at the Unitarian Universalist Church in downtown Eau Claire. On March 12th, it's Davy J. and the Jones Tones. Music begins at 6:30 p.m. Information at ChippewaValleyBlues.com. Well, it's called Lasagna Gardening. It might help to add this, sheet composting. You see, now you know the correlation to lasagna. And the guy who's real successful at it and is coming to tell us about it is named Roger Reynolds. He lives near Lone Rock, Wisconsin, and his presentation will be at the L.A. Phillips Memorial Public Library this coming Monday for a couple sessions that, if you don't like weeds, you may find it very worth attending. Permaculture design, organic principles, edible landscaping, KISS, functional art, emulating nature, and low input, high output. Those, I read, are key concepts of your work, and all that simply because you hated weeding the vegetable garden as a kid.
Yes. Yep. And for those who don't know, KISS stands for Keep It Simple, Sweetie.
Oh, it went to Sweetie.
Yeah, well, that's in a little nicer version, don't you think?
Well, it is, sure. Yeah. Depends on who you're talking to.
Yes.
And your mantra is less work, more food, flowers, and fun. That'll get your attention. Define what a sustainable landscaper is.
Yeah, the word gets thrown about a lot. So it kind of goes in line with some organic principles, but not as strict. But we're not adding anything to the garden that is not life-promoting. So if we have a problem, we try to find a life-promoting solution as opposed to finding a poison.
Mm-hmm.
So that might be, you know, birds eat a lot of insects. Can we bring more birds into the garden that will eat the worms that are on the cabbage? That's one idea. The other thing is looking for local things. My garden religion is mulch. And so instead of getting peat moss from Canada or some cypress chips from down south, what leaves or old hay or wood chips do we have? What things do we have locally? And then also, in this style of gardening that I teach, this deep mulch gardening, we never till again. So we're reducing our use of a machine and our reduce of gasoline. So kind of a whole concept of looking at the whole system and where can we find places that make it less work for us, which is, of course, sustainable, and getting local products and being kinder to the environment.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Do you have a website?
I do have a website. It's a little bit long, but it's not that hard. Infiltratinglandscapes.blogspot.com. infiltrating landscapes. It's like water soaking into the ground or ideas going out across the land.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that because that's...
Unintended.
Yeah, infiltrating is kind of a word that you wouldn't necessarily associate with gardening, but that's pretty cool. You know, and reading some of the materials, there's a lot of common sense in what you do. For instance, you talked about the fact in one piece I read that nature doesn't give us bare ground. Weeding is simply fighting Mother Nature, and we seldom win that battle.
Yep.
But you have a way, and in your way, what do? Do you fool Mother Nature? Do you stymie Mother Nature? What do?
I work with Mother Nature.
Probably a good idea, because she's pretty powerful, yeah.
Exactly, and she's been doing this a lot longer than we have.
Yes.
The permaculture ideas and concept is looking at nature and trying to emulate nature.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we step back and look at what does nature do, when I give presentations, I'd like to ask, you know, when does nature till the soil the way we do? When does nature leave the soil bare? And pigs are the only thing I can think of that maybe emulates our tilling methods. And other than some arid places, the soil is not left bare.
Right. And yet, between plants in our garden and between rows, we want it bare.
Right. This is some, I don't know if it's a Puritan ethic, some brainwashing, why we got to wanting everything bare. But nature always mulches the soil, whether it's grassland or woodland or prairie. There's always this year's plant duff left on top of the soil at the end of the growing season. And seeds need a couple things to trigger germination. They need a lot of things, but they need two things at the exact same time. They need good soil-to-seed contact so they can get enough moisture to trigger germination, but they also need a little bit of light, and we don't always think about that.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, that light tells the seed that there's nothing growing above me. It's a good time to grow. So when we try to have the soil bare, we keep the soil fine particles, so seeds have good soil-to-seed contact, but they also are getting struck by light. So every time that the weeds grow up and we go through and till the garden again, we're just setting the stage for what Mother Nature has evolved over thousands of years for a new crop of seeds to germinate.
Mm-hmm. Spectrum West deals with the arts, and we've in the past expanded to talk about culinary art, and now it's only right that we include horticultural art, and you're pretty proud of your ability in that regard. We are talking with Roger Reynolds, and the topic is, it's been labeled lasagna gardening, and he's bringing that presentation and more to the L.E. Phillips Memorial Public Library in Eau Claire on Monday for a couple shows. I believe it's 12:30 and 7 p.m. If you've ever made lasagna out there, you know it's made in layers, and that, Roger, is how you put a garden together. Tell us about that, and this is the mulching part, right?
Right. What I really love, and sustainable, not using any machines other than what brings us the materials, we start by smothering the existing vegetation, whether that's weeds from last year in your garden or existing turf grass or some brambles. We just are going to lay down either cardboard or newspaper right over that to smother that existing vegetation. Then we're going to pile dead plant material and possibly livestock manures if you have them, but they're not required. And that we're going to pile that about 18 inches deep, this knee-deep mulch. Water that 2 to 3, maybe 4 weeks, and it'll get rehydrated or re-wet other than the top couple inches. And then you plant directly into that. We don't till. We don't dig. And because of this mulched layer on top, a coarse layer on top, there's not going to be weed seed germination. So my garden, one that I really kind of kept notes on, was 30 by 50 or 1,500 square feet.
Mm-hmm.
And through the entire growing season, I had less than 5 minutes weeding.
That's my kind of gardening.
Yes, it makes garden. I like to tell people, you no longer have that summer garden guilt, where you go out to the garden and you just feel guilty because there's weeds everywhere. And now you go out to the garden with a beverage of your choice and walk around, look at what's ripe, and enjoy your little walk.
Oh, there you go. And mulch has a pretty broad definition for you. There's lots of things that you can use as mulch.
Yes. Yeah. And back to the sustainable part is I want things that will break down. So I don't use plastic mulches. But basically, I use the term dead plant material. So from weeds to, you know, weeds that you've pulled up, there's, of course, the classics. In the urban setting, the most available thing are leaves in the fall. And rurally, old hay and old straw work really well.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the ones around Wisconsin that are most abundant. But, you know, wood chips are fine. They have to be used. They can't be the whole depth. They can only be like a 2 to 3 inch top dressing. But sawdust can be mixed in. We can use shredded paper. Obviously, we're using newspaper and cardboard. Corn stalks can be used. Basically, any dead plant material will work, including, you know, an old sheet, cotton, stuff from your vacuum cleaner bag. All the materials that we have, you know, our cloth, if it's a person who's a sewer or you have clothes that get old, the question is, denim a dead plant material? It's cotton.
Now, is it a mistake to put grass clippings as a mulch because there's weeds in it?
No, it's not. Grass clippings are great.
Because a lot of people empty their, you know, their grass catchers in the garden. That makes it pretty anyway.
Yep. It covers up the soil. It gets a mulch on there. The basic rule of thumb, if you got quack grass or peeping Charlie, one of those perennial weeds, dandelions, they already have a strong root system and they can grow up through a mulch if it doesn't have a smother layer.
Yeah.
But if you have new weeds germinating in your mulch, it's either too fine particle or it's not deep enough.
And you not only garden and grow things, but you grow big things. I mean, your tomatoes are kind of world class.
Right, yes. Typically, my tomatoes are anywhere from 6 to 12 feet tall, one plant.
Your tomato cages are part of your artistic nature, yes?
Exactly. Part of what I talk about and what I really like is edible landscaping. When we no longer have to till for weed control, we no longer have to plant in rows. At that point, we can design what I call a food garden, which is a mix of flowers and food plants. We can start to mix them up, and we can plant them in clusters and clumps and different ways, just like people plant their ornamental gardens. So then we start to have the garden not just look like this utilitarian row, bare dirt thing, is that it starts to have some visual interest. And when it has no weeds, that, of course, is more attractive. And then, to me, the next step is with a 7 to 9 foot tall tomato plant, I need a support structure for that.
Yeah.
And I have a friend who's a metal artist, and I worked with him. They're 8 foot tall metal sculptures that also have some pegs where I can put colored glass bottles on them. And it's also really a tomato cage. So this is functional art in the garden.
Oh, yeah. That's pretty cool. And proof is in the pudding, or maybe proof is in the petunia, because you sent a couple of photographs, one that showed a very barren piece of land, a little patch next to a building, and then the next one showed just a bountiful garden, a greenery. You're saying that that's what people can do?
That's what people can do in one growing season. I'll be talking next Monday at the library. Once the ground thaws, people can put this garden together. It'll be 2 to 4 weeks of getting it watered, and the pictures that you saw, that's one growing season. So we go from bare soil to a really lush garden in one growing season.
You also have a couple other presentations coming up in western Wisconsin. Tell us about those.
Yeah, the library in Plum City and the library in Rice Lake. We haven't set dates yet. We're working on that. But we should have presentation both at Plum City and Rice Lake libraries yet this spring. So people in those areas that can't make it to Eau Claire, check with your library over the next week or so. We should have those dates set to figure out when I'll be there.
Roger Reynolds, thanks for reminding us that this white stuff isn't going to be around forever.
We have a lush green summer ahead of us.
Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Al.
Ellie Phillips, Memorial Public Library, Monday, 12:30 and 7 p.m. Roger Reynolds, and spring is just around the corner. Really? No, it is. No, it is. Thought maybe you'd like to hear a little music, a little taste, a little hors d'oeuvre from a guy we're going to have on next week. His name is Paul Metsa. He's a singer-songwriter extraordinaire. He's coming to Stockholm.
Do not play with the matches, the matches will start fires. Or keep your feet above the flames when you're walking on the wire.
Here's what's on stage this weekend and beyond at Western Wisconsin Theater venues. Honk will be presented by the Eau Claire Children's Theater at 7:30 p.m. today, 10 a.m. and 1:30 p.m. Saturday, and 1:30 p.m. Sunday at the State Theater in Eau Claire. The Old Gem Theater in New Richmond is offering group performances for students third grade and up of I Never Saw Another Butterfly, beginning Monday and running through March the 22nd. Public performances are scheduled for Saturday and Sunday. The Tortoise versus the Hare, a production of the Missoula Children's Theater, will be presented under the auspices of the Neillsville Area Players at 3 and 7 p.m. Saturday at the Neillsville High School Auditorium. The Dixie Swim Club, a production of the Chippewa Valley Theater Guild, will open Thursday and play through Sunday and the following weekend at the Grand Theater in Eau Claire. The Music and Theater Department at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire will present the Johann Strauss II opera, Die Fledermaus, tonight, Saturday, and Sunday at the Gantner Concert Hall, Haas Fine Arts Building at the University. The Pirates of Penzance, a production of the Menominee Theater Guild, plays tonight, Saturday, and Sunday at the Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts in Menominee. And the Willow River Players production of Ole and Lena's Wedding plays tonight, Saturday, and Sunday at Ready Randy's Restaurant in New Richmond. Elvis, the Essence of the King, plays tonight, Saturday, and Sunday at the Fanny Hill Dinner Theater in Eau Claire. And the Eau Claire Children's Theater has scheduled auditions for Lily's Plastic Purse at 5:30 p.m. Sunday and Monday at the Oxford Theater in Eau Claire. And that's some of what's happening in live theater around the region. I'm Jim Oliver.
Man, there's lots going on in our neighborhood, isn't there? A Spectrum Memo, UW-Eau Claire is hosting International Culture Night at 7 o'clock next Thursday the 7th in Schofield Auditorium. It's open to the public and will include traditional music and dance, a global fashion show and a play, plus free food. Woo-hoo. From around the world. We want to get the word out early so you can be sure it's on your calendar. Eau Claire's shortest sidewalk parade kicks off at 12:30 p.m. Sunday the 17th, concluding at the Acoustic Cafe for the WHYS 6th Annual St. Patrick's Day fundraiser. Live music, an Irish menu, silent auction, and more. Information and auction item previews at WHYSradio.com. A big thank you to Hillary Crusan for promotional assistance for today's program. Be here next week when we welcome a couple music icons, Lucy Kaplansky, who's one-third of the dynamic folk group Red Horse, and the guy you heard a sample of just a while ago, guitarist Paul Metza. He's got some good stuff. We'll preview the Chippewa Valley Symphony Orchestra concert and talk with Jerry Way about his original musical comedy. And, of course, Singing in the Rain is coming to the Barron Spotlighters. Jim Oliver has that report. All that and more on the March 8th edition of Spectrum West. Have a great weekend, folks. See you next Friday.
Sarah Nix asking you to join me this Saturday morning at Monona Terrace for a live broadcast of Michael Feldman's What Do You Know? This week, Michael features filmmaker Kyle Patrick Alvarez. Alvarez will talk about his critically acclaimed new film, COG. It's based on a David Sedaris short story. Doors open at 9:30 a.m., so do not delay. That's this Saturday, March.